Welcome to Nourish and Shine, where I talk with passionate leaders in the fields of nutrition, functional and integrative medicine, and wellness, providing inspiration and practical advice to nourish your mind, body, and spirit, optimize your health, and live a whole vibrant life starting now. The Nourish and Shine podcast is provided for educational and informational purposes only, and it is not medical, mental health, or healthcare advice. The information presented here is not intended to diagnose, treat, heal, cure, or prevent any illness, medical condition, or mental or emotional condition. Please make sure you consult with a trusted healthcare professional before you make any changes. Today, I'm so excited to be talking with Melody Hartzler. She is a clinical pharmacist and functional medicine practitioner, and also a fellow Ohioan. She is just absolutely full of knowledge and so good at sharing it. We go deep into pre-diabetes, diabetes, we talk supplements, we talk diet, lifestyle, all sorts of things. As everyone knows, blood sugar regulation is so super important. So even if you don't have full-blown type 2 diabetes, I think you can still take something really valuable away from this episode. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Nourish and Shine. Today I'm talking with Melody Hartzler. Melody, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell our audience about yourself?
Sure. I am a clinical pharmacist. I practice in family medicine. I also teach at Cedarville University School of Pharmacy. So I've been involved with education almost since I was done with my residency. And then I also have a blog. And so I love functional medicine, integrative medicine, holistic health. So I talk about that on my blog at farmtotable.life. And I, like to share with my patients and also, just whoever's reading, different, ways to address things with a holistic approach.
Awesome. And how did you get interested in kind of the holistic approach in functional medicine?
Sure. So, through my pharmacy school training, as you probably also experienced, most of the education is very much, the Western, approach and standard, we were there to study drugs and how drugs work and how best to use drugs, which, obviously is part of my, job. But then, I trained in the VA system, which was very, guideline based. This is, evidence-based medicine based. And it's not that functional medicine isn't evidence-based medicine, but how we have to look at it is a little bit differently because we don't have these huge drug companies funding studies. But essentially, I got there through my own health journey. After my daughter was born, we had sort of a traumatic birthing experience, which is a conversation for another day because it's lengthy. But I'll just say my doula that I had hired was in jail the day that I went to deliver my baby. So that was not helpful start to the delivery process. Yeah, apparently she embezzled money, which she took my money too. Who knew? But that was just a little bit of a crazy story that just was a long drawn out process. And I felt like, just really sort of put the nail on things that might've already been disrupted in my microbiome and different things. I just, sometimes there's triggers that we recognize in functional medicine. And I think between that and just the first 5 weeks of my daughter's life and just figuring out the whole breastfeeding thing with oversupply and also with her being tongue tied and just lots of stress, I think just that period of time, really caused some issues for me. And then it wasn't until about 6 months to a year later that I started to realize I had constant abdominal pain. And, then my daughter was also, she was having food allergies. And then so we were trying to figure out those things. And as a parent, when you're feeding your child something, you're fearful that they're going to react. It caused me to have some anxiety about, feeding her and different things. So it just sort of started to, turn into, and then you become more anxious about why you have abdominal pain and you can't figure out. And this whole thing just sort of builds on each other. So, I went through the traditional, Western medicine process and, everyone's you're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. There's no reason to do any further testing. And that, when you realize that something's going on in your body that's not supposed to be going on, you know those things. And so just sort of looking for additional providers, I found. And it's interesting because there wasn't like one specific provider that I would say was the one that like absolutely like helped me heal. There was like multiple people on the journey. But you know, each person that, you know, I talked to, I got closer and closer to, and still to this day, like I have one lady that I work with who's amazing for acupressure, allergy treatments, and one lady that, you know, does great OMT. And then, you know, I have a chiropractor I see once in a while, but I also, you know, have, you know, other, you know, my colleague and I, you know, also help each other out a lot. So it's just, you know, I feel like you have to build that team, but so through the journey, I learned a lot about, I ended up having SIBO and, probably some fungal aspects to that, like candida overgrowth. And then, you know, addressing my daughter's gut health, which she had eczema starting to happen with some food intolerances. So I was always removing a lot of foods and I was feeding her and just, you know, learning lots of things about the microbiome along the way. So that's really how I got started. And then that's been, she's 5 now, which I can't believe. So we're still, learning, you know, to this day, but I feel like, you know, now I'm like diving into podcasts and, you know, all kinds of educational opportunities to try to, you know, learn more. And I'm practicing functional medicine in my, clinical practice. So I mentioned the outpatient, practice. I'm a pharmacist embedded in a family medicine clinic. And so I spend about, you know, I spend a lot of my time with patients with diabetes, but there's a lot of overlap between diabetes and the microbiome and, you know, the microbiome and metabolic syndrome in general. And then, so I do some functional medicine approaches with those patients, but then I also see a lot of people with IBS and a lot of people that have SIBO and a lot of people, you know, that just have, you know, this constipation diarrhea that, you know, they've been told is just this collection of symptoms and they get or been given a drug, and we can actually address some of the underlying cause of that and oftentimes reverse symptoms, which is really exciting. So that's what I really love, like have fallen in love with, is the fact that like people are really desperate for answers, just like I was, and then they can actually get answers and start to heal and start to feel better. When the same symptom presentation with other, you know, providers, including what, you know, I was taught in pharmacy school, like would have resulted in just a medication that they add to their list and they wouldn't have actually, you know, healed from, you know, what they were dealing with.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important story to share. And thank you for sharing your story, because there's so many people in that same boat that you easily get dismissed or given a medication and told like everything's fine, but really not getting upstream and getting at the root cause. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So today we're going to dive into diabetes. And I know, like you mentioned, that's a population you work with. Tell me a little bit more about kind of the functional medicine perspective on type 2 diabetes.
Sure. So there is a lot of, I think the underlying piece, you know, a lot of chronic disease starts with is inflammation. And so there's a lot of connections with the inflammation, not only happening because the blood sugars are fluctuating and in sort of turning on some of those, inflammatory processes, but inflammation, you know, also, you know, inflammation in the gut has also been linked to diabetes as well. And so some of the connection, there's a lot of connections with the microbiome and the metabolic syndrome, I guess, to start out with, is defined as, you know, like an increased waist circumference, elevated triglycerides, elevated blood pressure, elevated glucose, and low HDL. So if a patient has three of those things, then they're considered to have metabolic syndrome. And so when we look at metabolic syndrome, we see not only the, you know, fact that they're having these elevated sugars, but we also start to see, you know, even some of those complications that we term as macrovascular complications or big vessel complications are happening even in those pre-diabetes patients. And so, and then microvascular complications also, you know, sometimes occur early on. But so we have these, you know, elevated risk. And so how we address that from a functional perspective, you know, one thing I do is look at the gut. So there's a lot of correlation between, and I don't have a specific percentage off the top of my head, but a correlation between IBS and the gut. And so we're actually finding that things like short chain fatty acids, which are produced by the fermentation of the good bacteria in our gut, actually decrease the risk of developing metabolic disorders because they increase the body's ability to create cholesterol, like to develop cholesterol into bile acids. And so turning that extra cholesterol into bile acids is a beneficial thing. And then, you know, so that's excreted. They also, short chain fatty acids also are a direct energy source for the colon cells. And so it helps, you know, the signaling molecules there as well. And part of the signaling piece is that it actually, there's a hormone in our gut called GLP-1, which is a hormone that tells the body to secrete insulin. It tells the body that we're full. It tells the body, hey, we've got glucose here. We don't need the liver to make any more, because that's part of the process in type 2 diabetes. It sort of goes awry is that the signal of insulin and, some of the other hormones, it's the liver still producing this extra sugar, even though there's plenty of glucose around. So those short chain fatty acids that are produced by the gut bacteria are actually, part of the signaling molecules that produce those hormones that are involved in all of this. So that's pretty cool. But the problem is when we have, poor gut health and, imbalanced microbiome, we find that we, lose some of the short chain fatty acids and we're not getting those beneficial effects. So there's also some, evidence that shows they can modulate insulin signaling, in the fat tissue, preventing fat accumulation as well. So, there's been other studies that have shown that the microbiome can also, people that have diabetes may be deficient in bifidobacteria species, and also have an imbalance of gut microbiome that increases some of the inflammation in the gut and the hyperpermeability piece, which could then contribute to some damage to the pancreas. So, and part of that is through a component of gram-negative bacteria called lipopolysaccharide. That can sort of damage the cells, stimulate immune responses, start the inflammation process. And some of that gram-negative bacteria is just like bacteria that's in our gut that you wouldn't necessarily know, was there unless you, had a stool test or had some kind of symptoms that led you to looking for those things. So those are just, some of the relationships between the microbiome. There's also some pieces about the bile acid production in the gut microbiome. So if we don't have that, a bile can actually provide an antibacterial activity. So if we don't have, good pancreas and gallbladder health, sometimes there's a, sort of cycle that happens, and bile also increases the release of GLP-1. So if we're not getting good digestion, so it comes back to, when we're chewing and activating, bile, when we're, some people are just flying through the day, shoving food in their mouth. And in those cases, sometimes we, don't chew. We don't have that, mindful eating process that allows our body to sort of, initiate some of these things. That can then, affect our hormone signaling that eventually affects insulin signaling and down the stream. So there's lots of different ways that can happen. But from a function, is there anything else you want me to expand on there?
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And I think, okay. When it comes to prediabetes, I know you mentioned you're already seeing like macrovascular mm-hmm. complications. Can you elaborate for people who are maybe non-medical or just kind of concerned about prediabetes, kind of what constitutes prediabetes? And then also, like, what are some take-home points with like how they can address, like, if you're in that stage or you think you could be getting there, what are
sure you do? Yeah, so prediabetes is defined by a glucose level of, so this is a fasting glucose. If you haven't had anything to eat when you first wake up in the morning, at least for 8 hours, your glucose, if it's between 100 and 125, it would be considered prediabetes. Anything over 126 or above would be considered diabetes. And that does have to be repeated, or, not on like once on one day, once on another day, we see the same result because it's a one point in time test. And then if we're looking at the A1C, so hemoglobin A1C is measuring how much sugar is sticking to the red blood cells. So it's called a glycosylated hemoglobin test. So it's measuring, because red blood cells turn over, anywhere from 90 to 120 days That gives us sort of this 3-month average. And it's different, you know, it's not exactly 3 months, but it gives us about a 3-month average, of your blood sugar levels based on, you know, that number. And so that number, a normal one is less than, 5.6. So 5.6 or less would be considered normal. Most people, you know, healthy people without insulin resistance would probably be in the low fives or, you know, 4 range with an A1C. And so when we start to diagnose prediabetes, we get 5.7 to 6.4. And then anything over 6.5 and above is considered diabetes. And because this A1C marker is not a one point in time thing, it's this average. Essentially, when we test an A1C, if it's over 6.5, it becomes diabetes. If it's 5.7 to 6.4, we're in that prediabetes range. There's not technically an ICD-10 code for like to diagnose prediabetes. We consider it like impaired glucose tolerance or impaired fasting glucose. So, but if you get to that point, that's where a lot of it, I feel like a lot of the functional medicine principles are going to be most effective if we can address this early on. So if we can look at the microbiome, address anything we see going on there, whether that's, you know, obviously everyone's talking about probiotics, and probiotics can be good. And there's certain strains that, you know, have more evidence than others for, you know, increasing metabolic disease. And so working with a provider to figure out, you know, what the best, you know, one for, you might be, and then also prebiotics. So there's data for prebiotics as well for patients with diabetes. So prebiotics are those, essentially non-digestible food ingredients, that stimulate the growth of the good bacteria. So things like inulin, you'll see like FOS, which is a abbreviation for a fructose oligosaccharide, starch, lactose, cellulose, pectins, gums, like partially hydrolyzed guar gum is another good one. But a lot of those can cause some symptoms in patients that might have some bacterial imbalance. So we start taking prebiotics when we have this bacterial imbalance that you have a little bit of gas and bloating here and there. If you feed that bacteria with more food, then you can have more gas and bloating and, you know, distension and abdominal pain. And so a lot of times prebiotics are sort of a little later on in our protocol. So we normally try to address any abdominal symptoms first, especially if we're looking at a comprehensive stool test. We'll, you know, rule out SIBO, you know, make sure that things are better balanced and symptoms go away before we start to, you know, use those prebiotics. But partially hydrolyzed guar gum is a brand name, or like a trademark of it is Sun Fiber. It's also in like Thorne's Fibermend product, but it has some evidence for reducing postprandial glucose in patients that take it before meals. But it also can be one that's a little bit better tolerated than others. And so there is one particular study with that one where they took 6 grams of it a day and it lowered fasting and postprandial glucose levels as well as triglyceride levels in patients. And it also stimulated the bifidobacteria and that those bacteria that produce those good short chain fatty acids in the large intestine. So that would be one way to address it. There's also some other supplements that we like to use that are also beneficial to the microbiome, like berberine. So berberine is a plant-based molecule, but it has, you know, I sort of feel like it's like the panacea sometimes of supplements, although curcumin might be up there too. But it helps to reduce fasting plasma glucose, fasting insulin. There's also HOMO-IR is a abbreviation that is standing for a test that they run for insulin resistance in clinical studies. And so it also reduced insulin resistance. It can improve LFTs. It can modulate the LDL receptor. And it's actually considered a natural PCSK9 inhibitor, which is a drug class now that we use for, it's an injectable medication class that we use for patients with high cholesterol. And so this is actually like a substance found in nature that actually has that same effect, not to quite the same level, but still something that might be beneficial for patients, especially that are in those early stages of prediabetes or even metabolic syndrome. So it can lower the LDL cholesterol, total cholesterol, and also raise the HDL cholesterol, which is what we most of the time term healthy cholesterol. and then has some ability to reduce the LDL oxidation, which that's a whole nother conversation for a podcast, probably about particle sizes of cholesterol. But essentially, if the LDL are large and fluffy, they're a little bit safer. But if they're small and dense, they're more likely to be oxidized and contribute to heart disease at that point. So we really like berberine. It also has a beneficial effect on the gut microbiome. There's a particular species of bacteria, and I don't know if I'm saying it right, but it's called Akkermansia species. It's Akkermansia. But essentially, when that species is in abundance, there's less incidence of diabetes. So they find that people with diabetes actually have less amounts. So it's an inverse relationship. But both metformin and, which is a drug for diabetes, and berberine both increase that species, which is really interesting. And so with berberine, if people are going to use that for diet, for cholesterol, for blood sugars, to get the metabolic effects, you have to have about 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams a day. So some of the berberine products are intended for more microbiome balance and improving the dysbiosis. So in those cases, the doses are a lot smaller. So you have to make sure that you're getting a product that has the higher dose. So most of my patients start with 500 twice a day. And if they need an additional capsule per day, then we can, you know, increase that. And most of the time, side effects are generally just some GI upset because of that effect in the microbiome. But most people tolerate it better than, you know, like any of the medications that, you know, cause GI upset. So those things, there's also
the berberine along with the metformin.
Yeah, so we do. And I don't know that we have any clinical studies where they're used together to know if like we're getting a synergistic effect. You know, because a lot of times we add medications, you know, 1 + 1 doesn't always equal 2. It might, you know, be only 1.5, you know what I mean, with as far as like lowering of, you know, A1C. But I think, you know, for the most part, my patients that are doing both of them are doing well. Some people that choose to do berberine are people that don't want to take pharmaceutical medications. So they're, you know, going down that path. So it probably just depends, but you can use them together. There's not a drug interaction there. The main drug interaction is with warfarin. And then other things that we consider, there's some studies, especially prediabetes patients are often found to be deficient in zinc. So we'll test zinc levels, copper levels. We want them to be balanced, about 1 to 1. But in a lot of patients, they were able to supplement. One study was 20 milligrams of zinc and one was 30. I prefer to stick closer to the 20 because if we supplement with too much zinc, then we can cause the copper to become unbalanced. But in those studies, we saw improvements in fasting glucose. The what they call the oral glucose tolerance test. So that's that 2 hours after someone gets a load of glucose, what their blood sugar is, and then that insulin resistance marker, and also some improvements in cholesterol in those patients that were supplemented with the zinc. One study looked at CRP, which is a measurement of inflammation, and that also was improved. So those are, you know, some of the things I would definitely think about for prediabetes as a consideration. And then the other thing when we think about inflammation is also at our omega-3s. And so I'm sure you've talked probably about omega-3s at some point with other podcast guests, but there's some debate on, you know, do we use DHA? Do we use EPA? Because there's different, you know, formulations of omega-3s. Most prescription omega-3 products are actually a form of EPA. And so it's interesting, though, because there's a lot of data showing DHA is better than EPA in almost every trial. And when we're looking at just surrogate markers, and surrogate markers are just those lab values. So like when we look at the difference in triglycerides or LDL or, you know, even some of the insulin resistance studies, but there's no trials looking at DHA in, at least that I'm aware of, looking at DHA when we're actually looking at clinical endpoints like MI, cardiovascular disease, mortality. So that's where the pharmaceutical companies have gotten these EPA products. There is an EPA product on the market, which is ice icosapent ethyl, which is like an ethyl ester of EPA, excuse me. And that one actually has a clinical trial that shows benefit in patients with metabolic syndrome or diabetes in improving risk for heart disease events. And so that's one that a lot of times insurances will actually cover for patients. And so, you know, a lot of this function, a lot of my diabetes patients come to me because they know they can get help with their diabetes. They don't realize that I'm going to give all this other additional functional medicine type information out. But so in a lot of people that aren't sort of bought into the whole functional medicine process sometimes, or even if they are and like finances are a challenge, sometimes we'll start with the prescription product because if people have commercial insurance, there's like a coupon card, they can even get it for like $3 a month. So so there's options, you know, there as well. There's other things, you know, you could think about like lipoic acid, chromium, vanadium has some data, and cinnamon extracts have some data. So those are, you know, all things, but I think my first go-tos would be berberine, zinc, and addressing inflammation with the omegas.
And what sort of dosing are you using with the omegas?
So most of the pharmaceutical products studies were at 4 grams per day of EPA. So sometimes I'll try like 2 grams a day of EPA and 2 grams of DHA. So, but if, you know, it becomes expensive to do that much with some of the, you know, direct to provider companies that we like to use where we know that the quality is good. So it's really, you know, I try to get people up to 4 grams a day as much as they can afford, you know, to do.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that you shouldn't get this from diet as well. Like I'm not just trying to get people to supplement, but almost everybody I've tested for, there's a test we use for nutritional deficiencies, and it does an omega check that looks at, you know, your EPA, your DHA, all of those things in your body. And every single person I've tested has been, like, except for maybe one, has been deficient in omega-3. So I just think the American diet is really low in omega-3s. And it, you know, unless you're going to eat fish every day or, you know, make sure that you're getting some kind of source in your diet, it can be difficult to get that one from diet.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And the ALA from what we think of like chia and walnut and all those things, mm-hmm. only like a 10% conversion.
Yes. Yes.
To the active EPA or DHA. So mm-hmm. really, really good point. As far as diet and lifestyle goes, what are some of your favorite recommendations when it comes to type 2 diabetes?
So from a diet standpoint, you know, obviously everybody has their own opinion about nutrition and diet. And obviously I'm a pharmacist, not a dietitian, but I work with some fabulous dietitians. I finally found a dietitian group that thinks like, you know, myself and you and others, you know, from an integrative standpoint. But anyways, our sort of approach is that we try to recommend 30 grams of carbs per meal, which would get you about 90 grams per day for meals. And then if they do have a snack, to stick under 15 grams for the snack. So about a little over 100 grams per meal, which is not a super low carb diet. Because, you know, if we talk about keto, we're talking like less than 20 a day of carbohydrates. My challenge with keto, and I know people are doing well on it, I think it really should be a short-term thing for people that have, you know, a lot of weight to lose and as sort of a jump start to their weight loss. But I don't know that it's a great long-term option, especially because of a microbiome and how impactful the microbiome is in all of this chronic conditions. And without the fiber and the, you know, beneficial starches to grow the bacteria, the good bacteria, I think the keto becomes a little bit challenging. I've also seen some women develop some thyroid issues because we need insulin involved in the conversion of thyroid hormone. And so, I just think, you know, in general, maybe a moderate carbohydrate approach is a little bit better. But that, I mean, even our approach of around 100 grams of carbs per day or less, and I don't tell people they have to eat 100. I mean, if they want to eat 50, that's fine. But I think, you know, much less than 50 is probably a little too low for some of them. And I'm not talking that they're eating like fast acting sources of carbs. I follow more of like Mediterranean diet approach. Probably, I would say the Mediterranean diet is probably the most well-studied diet as far as clinical trials on a diet. As far as like decreasing inflammation, we think like lots of olive oil. I mean, there's some cardiologists out there talking about like having 4 tablespoons of olive oil a day. And I sometimes tell that my patients, they're like, you're crazy. I'm not drinking olive oil. You know, I see this like look in their eye. But it can be, you know, beneficial for patients to think like that. I mean, they can certainly, but that's, you know, a one way of supplementing, you know, some good, healthy, anti-inflammatory fats like the omegas we were talking about. But, so the ADA, actually their guidelines, American Diabetes Association, are even more, you know, high than that, but they're say what men can have up to 45 grams per meal or 60, excuse me, 45 to 60 grams of carbs per meal. Women, I think they cap at 45, but I've never taken care of a patient, with diabetes that could eat that many carbs and still have controlled blood sugars and lose weight. So I feel like, you know, I'm not sure why that the, you know, national organization supporting diabetes. I mean, I realize if someone has type 1 diabetes, they might be able to, you know, have a little bit more carbs because they're covering it with insulin. And as long as they're exercising and doing a good job in that aspect, they're probably able to keep, you know, keep their insulin resistance under control, that might be okay. But for people with type 2, that's generally not gonna work to have that many. So we try to stick with the 30. And then as far as exercise recommendations, I tend to, you know, a lot of people will come in and say, well, I walk, I'm really active around the house. And, you know, that's great. And I appreciate that they're, you know, up and moving around their house, but I really try to get them to dedicate specific time towards exercise and not just, you know, oh, I'm parking further from the, I hear that a lot. Like, I'm parking further from my office building, or I'm walking up the stairs. And while those are all good things, it's not getting our heart rates high enough to actually make, you know, much of an impact on the, you know, the insulin resistance and things like that. And I also encourage them to consider weight training. And now I have patients that are, you know, in their 20s up to, you know, one of my patients this morning was 82. So like, you know, some of them are even older than that. I have some people pushing 90. So, you know, the conversation we have about exercise at, you know, 82 versus the conversation we have about exercise at 20 something is going to be a lot different. But everybody, you know, we try to encourage the movement that they can do. And so, you know, if we can do weights and, you know, some kind of resistance training in addition to some cardio, that would be ideal.
Yeah. I love that you bring that up, because when I was pregnant, I had gestational diabetes, and I found absolutely the most benefit from weight training when it came to blood sugar control, hands down over cardio. And looking to the research, I think it pretty much says that as well.
Yeah.
And it also, I think, is just a good stress reliever. And I know stress is something we wanted to kind of dive into too when it comes
So stress can, you know, my patients sometimes are like, well, I woke up this morning, my blood sugar was 100, but by the time, you know, I get to work, and after I had one patient bring in a monster drink one day, I don't understand why my blood sugar increases. This is like sugar free. And I thought, you know, like all that caffeine is like revving up your adrenal glands and causing, you know, cortisol production, which is raising your blood sugar, even though you're not, you know, drinking any, actual, you know, sugar. And so I think, you know, that's important, to, you know, watch how the caffeine affects the body. I think the coolest, you know, one of the things that has been like practice changing for me is the availability of continuous glucose monitoring for patients. So there's multiple different continuous glucose monitors. And the cool thing about all these, you know, companies sort of out, you know, competing with each other right now is that it just keeps getting better. But the one that's the most available to patients with type 2 is called, the Freestyle Libre. And so patients can get that, you know, the meter is most often less than $100, and the box of sensors is normally $75 or less per month. And they can monitor their blood sugar like every single minute and see what it is without pricking their fingers. And so that's really helpful. I've worn both the Libre and the Dexcom, which I also love. Dexcom, it's just a little harder to get if they're not type 1. But I've worn them, or type 2, on like multiple daily insulin injections. But they're both just awesome because you're just like, you know, reading it like, oh, hey, what's my blood sugar here? I don't even have diabetes. And I'm like, oh my goodness, what is this oatmeal doing to me? You know? And like, I imagine that if I did, I would be very cognizant. And my patients that do, you know, wear them are definitely more apt to know, you know, what, how food affects them and which food choices they should make or how exercise affects them or even how stress affects them. And so that can be really helpful for both the patients and the clinicians to know what's going on. I think I got off track a little bit there, but
I love the Libre. I wore one too. And it was fantastic. And it can become a little bit of an addiction.
I know.
A lot. I always would tease, like, I might have checked like 50 times today, but you know, mm-hmm. you get a really good trend and I like to see that data.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's some people that, and there's studies to show that just putting on a Libre can lower your glucose because you're more aware of it, and not even doing any other interventions. And so, especially for the people that are making, I think, you know, a lot of the earlier studies where they were like, you know, we have physicians that are like, oh, I don't prescribe my patients a glucose monitor because there's no studies that show it's effective until they're on, you know, injectable therapy or insulin. And while that's true, you know, in the general population, if we look at those patients that are highly motivated to make change, those glucose monitors and those CGM monitors are super effective you know, helping people to guide those, you know, interventions that you're doing. Because if you can't see the results, what's the point in, you know, I feel like you lose interest in what you're doing, or you don't have the motivation to continue if you're not seeing the results. And so when they can see it real time, it can be an obsession, but it can also be very helpful to getting things under control. But back to your question about stress. So stress, you know, the challenge that with stress is that, you know, our bodies were designed to, you know, everyone always uses the analogy, like run from a bear. So when the situation is you're in a stressful situation, there's a bear running at you, your heart rate is supposed to increase so that you get more blood supplied to your legs and, you know, you're able to run faster, and the blood is going to be shunted away from your stomach and the digestion. And, you know, it's this colon's going to, you know, it stimulates the colon, but it doesn't, you know, you're not going to be digesting in resting and digesting at that point. And so when you're under this chronic stress, where you're always, you know, sort of running from a bear, but it's not really a physical bear, and you're sitting, you know, at the same time, we start to, you know, see some of these effects, and that creates sort of this, you know, room for this improper digestion. And, over time, that suppresses the reproductive system, can even hinder growth in children, you know, can change, you know, appetite, weight gain, it can affect your, you know, immune system. And so we want to definitely be cautious about that. But from a diabetes standpoint, there's definitely a link between, we call it HPA axis. So this is this axis between your brain, the brain sending this signal to your adrenal glands to make hormones. And so the adrenal glands sit on the top of your kidneys, and those make the stress hormone called cortisol. And so patients with diabetes tend to have higher cortisol levels. They have a flattening of this cortisol curve. So your cortisol level should be higher in the morning, and then it should slowly sort of taper off throughout the day. And so, I mean, there's pictures online that you can Google and see what the curve looks like. But, and so the patients with diabetes also sometimes post-stress recovery is weakened, and this imbalance between, with this HPA axis dysregulation, and so there's also another study that showed the degree of cortisol secretion was related to the presence or degree of cortisol secretion is also related to the number of diabetes complications. So people that had higher stress often had more complications. And so stress management should really be a part of our diabetes protocols. And so, you know, one of those things is also getting better sleep. A lot of my patients with diabetes and prediabetes, they'll come in and say they sleep 4 hours a night, or, you know, even anything less than probably 6 hours is probably not enough from a metabolic syndrome standpoint. And so we definitely want to make sure that they're resting. So their body, and there's a lot of like cognitive cleansing that goes on at night too. So I forget what the medical term for the cleansing of your brain that happens when you're sleeping. But there's some term out there for that. But essentially, you know, the time when you're sleeping is really a time for your whole body to be, you know, rejuvenated. And so even if, you know, you might be able to get by the next day by, you know, drinking caffeine and going through this cycle, the body really does need some deep sleep and restful sleep. And there's also supplements to address stress, like ashwagandha is a herb that's been used historically, or rhodiola. A lot of times I find the lavender oil. There is actually a product that is trademarked as Celexan in Germany. There's a product in the United States by Integrative Therapeutics called Lavella. But essentially, it's like lavender oil in a capsule. But it's been studied in anxiety against pharmaceutical agents and has been shown to have higher readmission rates and be beneficial on quality and duration of sleep and mental health. And I find people sometimes just like feel a lot more relaxed when they take it. And it's really side effects, you know, less than 5% have GI upset. So it's not super, you know, and like compared to some of the other things like benzodiazepines that has been studied against, it's definitely obviously a better option from a dependency standpoint. I don't care if you take lavender every day for the rest of your life, but you know, some of the complications of some of the pharmaceutical agents can be challenging. So there's also the conversation about vitamins and their relationships to stress, which is why we like to look at nutritional deficiencies in our patients. But you know, a lot of the B vitamins are protective nutrients for the adrenals and can decrease the stress-induced B1 particularly decreases stress-induced cortisol response, as well as B5. B3 is involved with, you know, sleep quality. And so B12 helps to reset circadian rhythms. So I think actually this was part of my problem, you know, not realizing it early on, but after pregnancy, this being depleted in B vitamins and that sort of heightening some of my stressful experiences as I was dealing with, you know, my daughter's allergies and other things. And so sometimes I feel like it's something that we don't necessarily look at unless they're considered anemic and they're starting to experience symptoms because their blood cells aren't being formed properly, which eventually would happen. But sometimes in that early stage of some of these deficiencies, we, you know, don't necessarily, you know, address them until it's, you know, a lot worse.
That's such a good point. And I think when it comes to diabetes, it's kind of a vicious cycle because diabetes in itself can cause lower levels of B vitamins. And then mm-hmm. some of the medications like metformin,
yeah.
And then, you know, also, if you have lower levels, then you can have more problems with blood sugar regulation. So I think, it can be quite a cycle.
mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, statins and CoQ10, like if people are taking medications. So yeah, there's a lot of things. And so it does become, you know, complex when you look at the whole picture, which is why, you know, it's not like a 15-minute, you know, appointment. And I always say that, you know, primary care providers could provide great diabetes care if they had 45 minutes to an hour with their patients too, but that's not like the case in most primary care offices. And so that's why I'm glad that I get to sit down with them for a longer period of time, typically 45 minutes at least, to, you know, dive into these things. And of course we can't address all of this thing in one visit, but, and it's going to be dependent on my, patients, you know, which, path they take. You know, I talk about these functional things and I talk about the conventional medications, and it also depends on sort of what stage they are in their diabetes, if we might need to use some pharmaceutical medications, you know, alongside some of these interventions. I mean, because we don't want to leave things super high until, you know, we get it under control, because that, you know, also damages the cells in the body. So we want to get them under control. And then if we can, after we get some weight loss, sometimes we try to wean off those. So for example, one of my patients, you know, he really, you know, eventually wants to be off medications, but needs help with weight. So we're using a GLP-1 agonist medication, to try to, you know, help him get there. I've had other people, I had one guy that really took, and he was all about the keto diet, which I didn't necessarily, you know, suggest that to him. I just suggested the lower carb approach, but he had been eating a large number of carbs before. I mean, he went down, I mean, drastic weight loss, and pretty much reversed his diabetes using CGM. And he was using metformin for a while, but after he lost all the weight, he didn't even need metformin anymore. But he was a new onset diabetes. So really, a lot of these things are so much more effective if we can really hone in at the beginning of the disease process. Now, my goal is always to get people off insulin if we can, as much as, you know, there's great, awesome ways to deliver insulin now and new molecules that help it be safer. You know, I still feel like for most people with type 2 diabetes, if they're not into a point where their pancreas isn't making insulin anymore, you know, there's other ways we can address this if the patient is willing to make the effort. And so it has to be a diet and exercise, you know, potential supplements, also maybe some other pharmaceutical agents that address some of the pathophysiology. So particularly, you know, GLP-1 agonists, SGLT2 inhibitors are actually addressing some of the pieces of the puzzle that are broken for patients with that are, you know, not functioning properly. And so that's where I think some of this research is really cool with microbiome, is that we're actually, you know, influencing GLP-1, like, and that's sort of our pharmaceutical target as well. But yeah, I mean, overall people, you know, I've seen a lot of improvement in treating their gut health as far as their gut symptoms and things like that. So the patient that came in, and she was pre-diabetic, or actually just, I think her A1C was 6.5. She had elevated LFTs and she was really worried about her liver. She didn't know what was going on. Like, they had done some other tests and everything else was fine. So her doctor was like, well, we should just monitor. But, she was also having some constipation, diarrhea symptoms. We ended up testing and she had H. pylori. And so we did some natural treatment for that. So we used mastic gum in her case and in a product called Gastromend. And then we also used berberine and a low carb diet, started getting her exercising. And she didn't have, and her A1C was less than 6.5 after that. And the H. pylori, when we retested, was also gone. So that was pretty exciting to see. And, you know, right now she's still doing well without being in that classification of diabetes. And so, you know, after we did that, we also started probiotics and started, you know, combination probiotic, prebiotic to try to, you know, rebalance the microbiome to prevent the reoccurrence. And so that's, I think, the big thing with the gut things is we have to try to make sure that it doesn't happen again. So, you know, if it's SIBO, we need to think about why did that happen in the first place and address the motility piece of it. And then if, you know, if it's just, you know, general, large intestine dysbiosis, then, you know, is motility an issue or do we just need to get, you know, high dose probiotics in there to sort of crowd out the, you know, bad ones. And then, you know, how long do we have to continue that for? You know, we might be able to back off at some point, but just a lot of times just the antibiotics or the antimicrobial herbal stuff just doesn't work by itself. So we have to, you know, we do it and then we have to, you know, now rebuild. And that's the challenging part because we don't have as much evidence on the rebuilding part, as far as like what actually stays in the microbiome and do we need to continue these lifelong, you know, we know they're active when they're there, the strains and our probiotic strains, but, you know, getting them to take residence or, you know, getting influential changes. We, you know, even the prebiotics, we know they're growing bacteria in certain cases, but we don't always know, you know, exactly which ones and is it the one we want to grow and all those things.
As far as other like tracking devices or technology, do you guys get into that? Or are there any things that you found lately that you like?
So we use the Libre Law, we use Dexcom, Medtronic, as far as like Apple Watch and things like that, like if people have it, you know, we can certainly, you know, use those things, you know, but I guess it just depends on the patient and, you know, what they have available to them, you know, to be able to work with, you know, they can use pedometers and things like that. But I don't know that those are always the best, you know, it depends on like mine. Like it's like some weeks I'm motivated to like beat my circles and then there's some weeks that I'm not. But so I don't know. Have you found any that particularly, you know, work well for you?
No, it depends. I like, as far as mindfulness goes, I really like the Muse.
Yeah.
in other episodes, but I love the tracking ability there. I have the Aura Ring, so I use the Aura Ring a lot. I haven't had any patients that have it though. But I think that's the best sleep tracker I've come across. And then I like Nutrition IX is an awesome app for like food tracking that, like all the vitamins and minerals as well. So when you're looking at like, what are you getting from your diet? It's a nice way to be able to quantify that.
Yeah.
No, those are a few of my favorites.
Yeah. We use, MyFitnessPal a lot to like recommend to the patients, cause it has a lot of the fast food, you know, restaurants and things like that in there. So that one, can also be helpful, when they're trying to stick to their carbs, you know, at home.
So I wanted to ask you about one of your projects, which is functionalmedicineCE.com. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So the challenge, of functional medicine, training for a lot of people is that it can be really expensive. And even functional medicine providers can be expensive. And part of that is because you have to spend a lot of time digging in, you know, and uncovering, you know, what's going on, in the patient. And so it's not just a 15-minute conversation, like I mentioned. And so, you know, that can be challenging. And so because, you know, Institute of Functional Medicine is great, but to spend a week at a conference, you know, that requires, you know, plane travel or driving and a hotel stay and, you know, the conference fee. And so you're talking, you know, to complete the whole program is like $20,000. And, you know, some of the other programs that are, you know, more web-based are, you know, even a couple thousand dollars. But I know every day, there are, you know, people asking me about functional medicine training opportunities and where do they get, you know, CE from. And so, you know, I'm like, well, here's some CE opportunities, but even some of those trainings that cost all the calls, you know, thousands of dollars don't necessarily all have CE for pharmacists. And so I was like, okay, pharmacists want CE on this. And I had even a couple times, done, you know, some CE programs at national meetings and then resubmitted some, you know, broader, like more in-depth, I guess, longer programs. Cause before I had just talked about pre-diabetes at a national program. So we expanded to talk about, not just pre-diabetes, but talking about metabolic syndrome and some other aspects to be able to, you know, address in their patients. And then I just kept getting denials from those, you know, organizations. And I thought, okay, well, if they don't want to have this at their national meeting, then I'm going to put a conference together and we're going to offer it online. So the cost is, you know, lower for the participants. And so that's sort of where the functionalmedicineCE.com was born. And so we're able to offer pharmacists CE at this time. Eventually we might expand that, into other CE programs and, or, you know, other CE providers. But right now we're focused with pharmacists, but that doesn't mean that other, you know, people can't join us. So we have a non-pharmacist price for the conference as well. So whether you are, you know, another healthcare provider or even a non-healthcare provider that's really interested in functional medicine, you know, that conference is, you know, was, I guess, November 9th. And so there are still, video opportunities to learn, you know, from those modules and things. And so the whole, you know, first symposium, we are talking about, you know, functional medicine, nutrient deficiencies, dysbiosis, so that's my section and talk a lot about the gut and dysbiosis. And then we're going to also have like an, how the gut relationship to the immune system. And so we'll talk about, there's one CE presenter, Laura, who I think you know, yeah. I had interviewed before, the foodie pharmacist. She's going to be talking about, the immune system impact from the gut. And then our, afternoon sessions were focused on hormones. And so bioidentical hormone replacement, and then, you know, looking at that and sort of how we assess that, as a pharmacist and, you know, as part of the care team in functional medicine. So yeah, so really, you know, health coaches would be great to, for this material. Anybody who wants to learn more, take a deeper dive, for themselves. I mean, it's definitely going to be presented to a pharmacist audience, but anyone is welcome to join us.
Yeah. And the non-practitioner price I'm looking at right now, or non-pharmacist price, is super reasonable. So
yes.
I think, you know, Those are all such interesting topics. And knowing you guys and knowing Laura, I know the content's going to be so good and so factual and just really, really well done. So I'm super excited to see it. And I highly recommend people check it out. A couple questions I always like to ask. The first one is, what does the word nourish mean to you?
Well, I think the first thing I think about when you say nourish is like, I guess, you know, I think about food first, I guess, because that's what we're, you know, we're sort of trained to think from a societal, you know, aspect in nourishing our bodies. And, you know, but I also think about spiritual nourishment and also, you know, my relationship with God and relationship with Jesus. And so I think, you know, not only is what we're doing here for our bodies as far as putting good food in our bodies and, you know, nourishing relationships, but I think like ultimately all of what I'm doing, at least, and other people, that profess Christ are doing, or, you know, or we're trying to, you know, nourish our relationship with Him. And so I think when I'm really at peace, and, you know, not in a crazy busy state, I think, you know, that's what I, you know, draw back to. And I sometimes get away from that when it becomes too busy. So I think, you know, what nourishes my soul, I guess, is that in scripture and things like that.
What's one thing you do regularly for self-care?
I would say vacation, but I don't get to do that as regularly as I like, but I was on vacation last week at St. John and it was amazing. We went and left our kids with my in-laws and it was wonderful. So I normally do try to make it to the beach, once a year, for self-care. And normally I would say it's more self-care when I get to go with just my husband than it is when the kids tag along. But at the same time, you sit there watching other kids like, man, I wish they were here. It's just such a funny paradox. But I would say, you know, massages are something I do regularly on a monthly basis. I also get OMT, which is osteopathic manipulation, on a least monthly basis, sometimes more often if I'm all out of whack. And then my last thing that I probably do, you know, we do go to church every Sunday morning and as much, you know, as long as we're in town. And I think just, you know, friendships and engaging in our community is an important part of our, you know, self-care, even though it seems silly, but I'm an extroverted person. So, engaging with people is part of that, even though it seems counterintuitive to self-care.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Yeah. Like hospitality is probably one of my spiritual gifts. And so I feel like if I'm not doing that, then I'm not like being myself and what I was, you know, designed to do. So.
Oh, well, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for being a guest today on the podcast. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. And if people want to connect with you and find out more, can you tell us where to go? And I will link everything up in the show notes as well.
My website for my blog is Farm to Table, PHARM2TO. So it's farmtotable, .life, LIFE. And I'm also on Instagram and Facebook, farmtotable.life. And then the functionalmedicineCE.com. You can spell out functionalmedicineCE or you can put FXMedCE, either one will get you there. And we're FXMedCE on Instagram and Facebook as well.
Awesome. Thank you. And I will link everything up in the show notes. So thank you so much for being a guest. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening to Nourish and Shine. I hope that you enjoy this episode and that you'll leave me a review on iTunes so that more people can hear the podcast. I'd also love to connect with you on social media. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I would love to hear your questions, so please send them my way. Also, you can check out my website. It's amysopola.com. I hope that today's interview provided you with some inspiration and practical advice to nourish your mind, body, and spirit, optimize your health, and to live a whole, vibrant life. Please join me again next week for another amazing interview. Have a wonderful week.
The Nourish and Shine podcast is provided for educational and informational purposes only, and it is not medical, mental health, or healthcare advice. The information presented here is not intended to diagnose, treat, heal, cure, or prevent any illness, medical condition, or mental or emotional condition. Please make sure you consult with a trusted healthcare professional before you make any changes.